Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, recorded on April the 24th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Swarthout, and I'm joined by my co-host, Andres Sandate. How's it going, Andres?
Good, Robert. Lots of stuff happening in crypto land.
Yeah. We're going to have a bunch of speed rounds here. I don't think we get to say more than five words about each one and still take 30 minutes here. So why don't we probably just dive right in.
Yeah. Well, I thought the first one, you might need more than five words. Is this true? Is Gensler really potentially going to resign?
I think that he was maybe trying to bait Twitter or crypto Twitter a little bit. I don't know if he's directed at crypto Twitter, but he certainly put it on Twitter. So he tweeted back on the 17th, and it literally reads, "It's been an honor to serve as the SEC chair. Over the 3 years, I've seen firsthand the incredible staff, blah, 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 blah." And goes on with this big thread about all of the accomplishments that they've done in his eyes. When I first read that tweet, I like read half of it. I'm like, okay, I got to start over and reread it again. And I was like, is he like literally resigning via Twitter? That does not appear to be the case, but he definitely probably got a little bit, maybe this is a glimpse into his sense of humor here. So
yeah, tease something out. Yeah,
absolutely. So, but, you know, on the topic of, maybe chairs not being around, you have the Chair Crenshaw. Her term is set to expire June the 5th. And mm-hmm. From everything that I've seen and read, there is no talk about her replacement or asking to go up for re-election. Obviously, the Senate has, I believe, approved that. And it's a interesting spot. But obviously, we're in an election cycle. Like, what is that? How does that play into it? And obviously, it's important to have an odd number when it comes to an SEC, you know, the five chairs there, including Gensler, voting on things. And typically, it's one vote is the deciding vote, because it's a 3-2 vote. It seems to be pretty popular these days. So I don't know what the plan is. It'll be interesting as we get closer. We're only probably 5 weeks out from that. So
is Crenshaw pro crypto or no?
Very anti. She has been all the no votes. So, you know, you can't be more extreme than a no vote. So maybe there's a glimpse of hope here that we get someone else introduced and kind of voted on in the Senate. And again, there's plenty of Senate Democrats that are pro crypto that might vote for a chair. And obviously there's more to a chair than just their opinions on crypto, but that's the part that we tend to focus on the most. So, you know, and I guess the last little piece here in our third bullet point there is two attorneys resigned this week. They were part of the SEC enforcement division, and they, basically the court in the debt box case, we won't get into that here, but it was a case where the judge reprimanded SEC for basically lying in court and gave them a chance to come clean about it. They chose not to come clean about it. They kind of doubled down. So the court really kind of smacked them around. And two of the attorneys that got basically resigned that were in the middle of that problem, they had only been the SEC a short period of time, like 1.5 or 2 years. And one of them literally tweeted, I was one of the SEC lawyers that resigned today. I joined in 2023 and was in charge of leading the SEC meetings with ETF issuers. So obviously this hasn't been approved, any of them. My job was to stick my fingers in my ears and scream loudly every time they ask us how they can make their application compliant. It's like somebody's a little bitter.
Yeah.
And assuming he's being truthful, you know, you don't really know. What a mess. Like I prior to running this fund, like I remember thinking the SEC was an organization that people feared, but also respectfully feared, right? Because they were trying to keep the law of the land. And now you have a bunch of people picking fights in the playground. Pretty crazy how things have changed so much. So,
I remember watching a special on the regulators. I think it was in relation to the pharmaceutical industry. It seems like there's a lot of musical chairs that happens between, the whether it's the defense lawyers and their defense law firms or regulators back and forth. So we'll have to see in a week or two where this disgruntled lawyer lands. My guess is we'll be basically doing work on the other side of the table if I had.
Right. Yeah. He has some experience that is, maybe he made himself more valuable on that side of the table.
Yeah.
We will see. Yeah. It's but so our next topic kind of comes to the other side of the government. You have the legislators, in this case, Senator Loomis from Wyoming and Senator Gillibrand from, I believe, the state of New York.
Yeah.
And one's Democrat, one's Republican. It's great to see that bipartisan come together. And they've been working on this stablecoin bill draft and redraft. And I don't know what number draft they're on. They're probably on draft 8 or 10. It's been multiple years going here. But it's great to see them reintroduce it. And, you know, there's speculation that maybe it can won't get through just by on its own merits. It may get kind of tag along on another bill. Apparently, the FAA needs to be reauthorized sometime this summer. An important thing to happen.
And yeah,
that will happen. So maybe as much as I don't like to see pork on bills, maybe this could be part of a pork on a bill that kind of gets stuck on there and kind of gets to go through. So we'll see. When it comes to legislation, I've kind of used to change my opinion. I used to be optimistic about it. Now I'm like, I'll believe it when I see it. Like, it just doesn't happen. So.
Yeah. It feels like in the election year that we're in, something of this magnitude ends up, you know, getting maybe some discussion, but ends up, you know, being something that happens in 25. And we'll see. I do remember the FAA renewal several years ago, and that will gather a lot of media attention in the coming weeks. So,
I mean, it's almost like a similar, like, we need to shut down, you know, the whole government shutdown thing. It's like, it's important.
Right. Funding.
It will certainly hit the news cycle. I don't know. I don't know if they're, you know, Senator Loomis is the one that I've seen talk about this the most. I don't know if she's using this as an opportunity to try to get some light on the bill and have people look at it, or if it truly actually has potential to do a tag along here. So I don't know. Time will tell. We'll probably know by, I'm guessing, July or something. I don't know the exact date of the FAA thing. So another part of the government. It seems like we're only talking about the government in this podcast.
I was going to say that today, maybe that's just indicative of where digital assets and crypto is when you're outside of maybe the project side of things and building deep in the tech, that so much of this industry is still getting sorted out, right? Legislation, regulation, taxation. I mean, it's a new asset class, right? So all these parties are weighing in, you know, because there's billions of dollars, right, at stake. So
yeah, it's a you know, it feels like it's going at a snail's pace, but you know, if you look back over a couple of years, probably see progress, but it's while you're in it, it feels like nothing's happening.
So the 1099
DA.
Hey, that seems, sounds close to the 1099 DIV.
Yeah. So DA for digital asset.
Digital asset.
The SEC, the IRS, has been kind of going through this drafting process. This form does not truly exist yet. It's currently in draft form as if it would go for tax year 25. I see problems with it personally, and I'm not an expert. I would love to know, you know, I was like reviewing this with Casey Smith yesterday, recording it for his podcast. And there's like, if you look at the first page of this thing, it's asking for the CUSIP number. There's no CUSIP numbers in crypto. Like, it feels like somebody took some other form, copied it, changed the title of it and changed a few fields and be like, here's our first draft. I know that the crypto industry.
Yeah. And crypto folks are going to highly scrutinize it. Right. Because you got, you know, I'm going to say you guys, we are living in it day to day and you come from a big bureaucracy and they're putting a form together, and I'm sure this is going to go through multiple rounds of comment and feedback and, but it's a first draft.
The first draft, it just feels like they want crypto people to take their taxes seriously. Like, why can't you take the form seriously? It just seems sloppy to me. For me, it's easy to pick apart. I get it. It's like, I just have to deal with the form whenever it comes around potentially someday.
But the overall purpose of this is to put a tax on digital assets. Much like income from stocks, for example.
To me, I haven't seen anything about, because I think that would come more from Congress about legislation, like that it's taxed at a different rate, whatever it may be. I think this is just, they're trying to gather more information that is specific to crypto. You know, there's parts in here about what's the transaction ID or what's the wallet and those kind of things that make sense. But, you know, even if you were to like squint to the QSIP field and be like, okay, maybe they're asking for the ticker. Maybe I'll put my ticker in there. But that doesn't make sense because you're not filling out a form for every time you have each crypto. And even if you use tickers, that's a little bit dangerous in crypto because there's some cryptos that use the same ticker. They're just on different chains. And so there's a lot here, I think, for them to work through. But I could also see, you know, this is, we're, goodness, a third of the way through the year already. Like, is this form going to be ready for next year? It could end up being a 2026 form pretty quickly. If it's not ready, I would guess soon. So
yeah,
time will tell. You know, taxes within the crypto universe are a pain, especially right. If you're an individual, because you can buy and sell on different exchanges. They're not helping you fill out cost basis. So there's software that uses it to help track, but the software's buggy. It's a headache. No one in crypto likes doing taxes. Even if you owe no money, it's still a
pain. Right.
So
yeah. Yeah. Part of this new asset class, yes. Lot of mud to sort of walk through.
Yeah, I mean, if I'll put my software developer hat on here, there's an opportunity for people here to write good software that has yet seemed to materialize, at least as far as I can see from my perspective. So, the 19th, was that last Thursday? Friday. Yeah. So Friday evening around 9 p.m. Eastern. So technically it was the 20th on computer time. The Bitcoin halving kind of rolled around. It was an event that people talked about leading up to it. And it was kind of like ho-hum, right? I mean, that's kind of what you want. You don't want there to be some massive explosion or anything like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was this the fourth halving and 28 more to go. There's 32 total. And we will all be 140 years old when we see the last one. And the year 2140 is the last projected date for the last Bitcoin to be mined. So that would be quite the ways off.
So the market, your reaction, the market's reaction is snoozed. Like, does nothing, right. Nothing happen?
Yeah, nothing happened. It was a Friday evening. I think that was part of it. But even if it was, say, a Wednesday, I'm not sure it would have been any different. It's, if anything, it's like a check the box. It's part of the cycle that we're in.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the Bitcoin maximalists seem to make a bigger deal out of the halving than anything else. I read this morning that, you know, so now that they were through the halving, the number of Bitcoin being mined each day is 425, down from 950, 900 down to 450, I think. And, you know, just this morning for the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF, I think they bought like 360 just for that one ETF. So like the new supply kind of matters, kind of doesn't matter. These ETFs are consuming, we've talked about this many times, consuming way more than is being created new. So it has to be sellers elsewhere in the market. So
yeah. The I think I mentioned to you yesterday there was one of the individuals that's out, you know, very much a crypto bull, you know, talked about Bitcoin at over 400,000. And I know you and I are highly skeptical when we hear these prices, you know, because it's like, what time frame are we talking about? Like, is it a 100-year time frame? Or is it, you know, a 10-year time frame? Remains to be seen.
Yeah,
the models to support those claims are out there.
Yeah, big eye roll for me when I hear price predictions without even some relative time frames on it. It's kind of like,
yeah,
you're probably going to be right. You just thought you got to wait a while.
So the NYSE is considering round the clock trading.
Yeah, for equities, and you know, I'm so focused on the crypto world. I read this headline. And the first thing that came to mind was like, oh, duh, it's all going to be on a blockchain and these things work 24/7. What's the big deal? And then I kind of had to step back and I'm like, wait, most people aren't going to think that. Most people are going to be like, oh, the markets are open, you know, from what, 9:30 to 4, got holidays, all those things. I think there's a lot to be figured out here. Obviously, the equities market is much bigger than the crypto market is at this point. And I think that they're, you know, going to 24/7, even if it's 5 days a week, not even 7 days a week, I think could have impacts that certainly need thought through around the news cycle, right? I mean, like the market shut down, kind of get a chance to breathe. I think part of the reason why the crypto market can be so vicious is the 24/7 nature of it. Like there's just no break. And there's no circuit breakers and all those things that are kind of been built into, you know, what we know is the equities market these days. So what you have any thoughts around this one?
Yeah. I mean, there's such a, when you go back and look at and understand like the functions of market makers, and a lot of this comes through when you're a licensed professional. Like if you have different securities licenses, you really have to, you know, pass these licensing exams. And part of that is understanding market structure. Mm-hmm. And all the different participants that are involved in the market. And of course, I think the everyday individual, if they, you know, put an order in for a stock, let's say they go and do it through their own brokerage account, or you know, they go on an app. You know, you can now do it through Robinhood, for example. Sure. Like that order goes, and the number of parties that touch that order for 10 shares of, you know, X or Y stock. Right. There's so many parties involved that you have to think over time that we get a T plus three, which is the settlement time. We get that down to, you know, I don't know if it's a day.
I think it's T plus one now.
But yeah, T plus one, I know on Robinhood, but you think that that gets down to potentially like a much, you know, smaller, lower amount of time. And I think that the idea of like round the clock trading, I could see, my immediate thought is market, not manipulation, because there's a lot of safeguards built in. But when you think about volatility in the crypto market and then volatility in, you know, your S&P 500 stock,
right?
It'd be interesting to see, you know, if this would be rolled out on a beta. But, you know, the markets are global, and I think the technology clearly is there.
Yeah, you know, it's
coming.
In a lot of ways, I kind of use the analogy in my head of the way the markets work to the way that the Swift wire transfer system works now. It's all about messaging. And then you have this settlement is on some other schedule, right? Like T plus one, T plus two, T plus three. Or in Swift, it could be five or six. And then you kind of bring into like a blockchain world, assuming it kind of moves that way, it's functionally atomic in the moment that it happens. So you go to basically T plus 0.0. It's, you know, maybe measured in seconds or minutes, whatever that blockchain's block cycle is, typically in seconds. And you kind of, it really changes the idea of how money moves and the ability, this whole idea of, do they have to, you know, I think maybe some people get caught with their pants down initially because they don't have, maybe they're trying to float it. I don't know if how much regulations are on that kind of stuff, but could be interesting. So.
Yeah, I step back and look at this. When you look at the news cycle and what we're covering in these crypto check-ins, like I said before we started, what jumps out to me, unless you're in more the building of the projects, you know, which is part of this whole industry, right? Before a token is issued,
right?
What you realize is, yeah, when we look back in 10 years, and the person that doesn't, you know, probably appreciate the history and the time and the work that went in, you'll look and say, God, why'd that take so long? Right. But at the end of the day, I mean, I feel like all these news headlights and check-ins, because it's legal regulation, uncertainty, projects, it's so much of it is about establishing the framework and foundation. And I think that's, you know, it's encouraging on the one sense that all these entities, governments, corporations, parties are looking at and thinking about the future of structures and markets. But at the same time, you know, when you're living in a day-to-day, right? And you live in such a short-term world, like you kind of sometimes ask yourself, like, man, is this, you know, stuff actually going to happen?
Yeah. And, you know, admittedly, it can be exhausting. Like
it
is news. I mean, it is happening, but always having to talk about what Congress is doing, or more specifically what the SEC is not doing, or doing to the industry, like, is, it's kind of like a broken record sometimes, it feels like.
Yeah. Well, the, you know, the money management industry, as we saw, you know, the asset managers, when they see opportunity and see an opportunity to make money, they will create products. So,
yeah,
you know, BlackRock did that with ETFs, and now it looks like they're doing that with a money market fund.
Yeah, so their money market fund, which is the, let me get the ticker of that one. That one is the, is the ICS is its ticker. It's a treasury fund, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And it's a, so the bullet point is, if you're watching this, is potentially a little bit misleading. So it did end up on Hedera. BlackRock is not the one that put it on Hedera. They were using a consultant that had a platform that runs on Hedera, to be absolutely clear.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a big deal. You know, admittedly, part of the thesis that I have around crypto is commercial use cases come first. You kind of get the replumbing behind the scenes. And BlackRock is, when they went from being super quiet about crypto to having an ETF to literally that same day, Larry Fink being on CNBC saying that, you know, what is next is tokenization. And man, they're moving much quicker than I would have ever expected. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is, to me, this is like a no duh, like this was going to happen. I wouldn't have said it would happen with this ticker in particular, but like it was going to happen. And we are, I don't know if we're off to the races yet, but like they're definitely, you know, stretching, getting in their blocks ready to kind of really start running. I think doing some tests here, more than anything else, test in the public market for that matter. So,
yeah. Yeah. They made a acquisition. You and I have talked about this before. They made, they being BlackRock, made an acquisition of a big global infrastructure group. It was their single largest acquisition in their history. And to me, that fits in the acquisition of this big global infrastructure manager fits in with this whole overall theme that we've been talking about around real world asset tokenization, RWA.
Right.
The idea that you could tokenize physical assets. We talked about real estate. We've talked about securities. We've talked about fund interests. So, you know, why can't you tokenize a toll road? Why can't you tokenize a bridge? Right. And the most liquid markets are, you know, treasuries, money markets, you know, these types of instruments. So I think it's happening. It's a matter of time, and the, you know, the biggest or second largest asset manager in the world, you know, leading the charge. I think we're going to see a real ramp up in activity over the next 3 to 5 years in this area.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. Hopefully it's sooner than 3 to 5 years is the only thing that I think I would change on that. So,
yeah, well,
we could be disappointed, but maybe I'll be hopeful on this one. So.
Yeah. So
we got,
do a crypto check-in without a Ripple update.
Correct. At least these days. It was quiet for many, many months before we were doing these. So a month ago, the SEC filed their request for penalty and the things that they think should happen to Ripple. Like there should be disgorgement. There should be an injunction, all these different things. And in just as a recap, the SEC asked for a collective between penalties, disgorgement, and interest of just shy of $2 billion, like $1.95 billion from Ripple. And everyone just thought that number was absurd, but, you know, it's the SEC. And they also wanted an injunction saying they could not use their ODL product be sold to U.S. customers. So Ripple had 30 days to respond. They filed it on the 30th day effectively. That was Monday. And they went through all the reasons why the SEC is wrong and all the things. And Ripple's basically said they came up with $10 million with an M. And again, the SEC is at $1.9 billion with a B. It's, you know, they obviously can't be much farther apart than they are.
Right.
If you kind of go through it, there was a case that happened in the last November, I think it was handled. And it was the actually in the debt box case of all things. We were talking about the attorneys there. Part of what came out of that, and it's in the same circuit as this court is handling this case in. So it actually is precedence that the court should follow. And basically they came down to, if you're trying to do disgorgement in all the things that the SEC is asking for, you have to prove that A, the person that got sold the XRP by Ripple actually lost money. The SEC has not been able to show a single case of that. Yeah. And it has to be within the US. So you start really narrowing down what the SEC thought that they were after, to the point where, like, I mean, this is unlikely to happen, but it could turn into that the that for previous and past sales that Ripple did, it turns into a $0 penalty because nobody lost money, that at least that has been publicly shared. And, you know, again, there's, you know, it's just funny how it's working, right? So then you flip through, okay, there's no way, I don't think that the judge allows Ripple off scot-free on this. Like, I think they're going to have to like hand over something. So yeah. That's where the penalty stage comes in. And they could be like, here, this sounds crazy. Here's a token $100 million penalty, right? And we can all be done with this. Would the SEC appeal? Would Ripple appeal? My guess is if they only had to walk away and pay $100 million, Ripple would be thrilled, write the check and, you know, get it done with. The SEC, I would guess, appeals just because they seem to, this has been very personal for them.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's, we're getting towards the end of this one. We should probably know the answer to this. Because the SEC has the chance by, I think, early May to reply to what Ripple wrote. And then the judge kind of gets to decide from there. And I think by July or August, we'll probably hear from the judge. So
the judge. I want to ask you about this before we go to our final topic for the day. If a normal company, like just that had a non-digital asset or crypto business, were in this long and protracted of litigation with their primary regulator, right. Would they look to settle, in your opinion? I mean, you're not a lawyer. I'm asking you kind of a sure. legal question, but
yeah,
is this benefiting Ripple to win this case and or pay? I mean, money's money, right? But right. like if they paid a $50 or $100 million fine, does that clear up uncertainty that unlocks a substantial path of growth for them?
I think it allows them to do their on-demand liquidity product in the US. So almost a certain yes to your answer okay. there. I also think that Ripple in some sense is fighting for the industry. They've okay. shown a path to how to beat the SEC. Most people just don't have the funds to fight. So they roll over, pay the fine early on. Yeah. And the SEC kind of gets this precedent, even though it's not legally binding, but they kind of have a gun that they can hold to other companies' heads, right? So you kind of have both things going on. Ripple, last I had heard, is paid, spent $200 million in legal fees fighting this.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you add in whatever they have to pay at the end. So, I mean, they Brad Garlinghouse has publicly said, he's the CEO, saying they will take this all the way to Supreme Court.
Yeah, like, yeah.
They're in it and they're going to the mat. I think part of that is the confidence, knowing that they've made some good progress here. They feel like they can continue to beat up the SEC that's maybe not on the best footing. But I think part of it is, you know, it's the current SEC way of thinking. If you have a different president and a different, you know, someone at the head of the SEC, maybe things are different and all this kind of goes away. You know, obviously that money can't be unspent. That was spent on this fight, but you can kind of stop doing some of these fights that are ongoing. You got the Coinbase one, which we hadn't talked about in a while, but it's still ongoing. And who knows? I mean, they've been sniffing around Ethereum a little bit and I don't know. It's... I'm ready to be through this stage in this gigantic book of crypto that is the SEC's chapter. Ready for that part to be over. So
yeah, yeah. It just doesn't feel like it's anywhere near around the corner. Well, the last update, Grayscale. We've talked about Grayscale. They filed an S-1 that came out, I believe it was yesterday.
Yes.
So it's available on the SEC's website for folks that want to go out and pull it down. Mm-hmm. And it's for an Ethereum mini trust.
Yeah. So they also recently filed for a mini Bitcoin trust. I don't understand the difference in the product between their trust and their mini trust. I think the fees are different from all that I've seen, but like, what's the difference? It's not an ETF, to be clear.
Yep.
They've also filed for an ETF. Like, it's just, I don't know. My guess is this is a bit of like, they're playing chess around the ETF applications and they're trying to move their pawns around. would be my assumption, but I literally have no basis for that besides just trying to come up with a reason. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's legal, and I'm going to say gamesmanship, there's legal strategy at work. I think in a lot of this where you're innovating, I think it's about trying to establish precedent. And I think there's probably a good, you know, podcast episode that we ought to do on how the Bitcoin ETF ultimately got approved. I know you have your theories, but I was explained, you know, one process where, you know, the issuer starts with a specific type of product, then gets to a second product. And ultimately all of that was done over multiple years in order to get to the final product, which is what they really wanted all along.
Sure.
But in order to establish this process, it's kind of like you have to go through these steps, and I don't want to say you box the SEC in, but you get, you know, you kind of get the goal, you get to the final objective in more of a roundabout way.
Yeah. It's, I just wonder like how different it would be if you just had an SEC, I don't care if it was Republican or Democrat focused, but like at an SEC that wanted to work with an industry and like went through this, would you be able to cut out two of the three steps? Like, or are all those steps required and we just have to, maybe we go through them quicker. I don't know. It would be something that I'm not qualified to probably answer, but it'd be a great conversation to have with somebody.
So. Yeah. I think we'd need a historian to talk about, you know, the beginning of, you know, the securities industry, go back to the 30s, go back to what was it like to get the 33 and 34 and 40 Act in place, from the time of the great panic, right, in 29 to when that legislation came out. And then I think another thing would be look at mutual funds. What was that like? What was the ETF industry like? I mean, these are different things because we're talking about crypto and digital assets versus like a wrapper around, for example, a digital asset. But I think, yeah, market structure, legal, regulatory, there's so many issues to kind of wade through. So,
yep.
But nevertheless, a full week of headlines in crypto land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wrap. So thanks for joining us on this episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In. If you want to stay updated on future episodes, you can find us in any podcast player by searching Teton Crypto Capital or Weekly Crypto Check-In. Take care.
Good to see you, Robert.